Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rachel O'Leary of Amnesty International, who talks about her group's recent report, which calls for an investigation of possible war crimes resulting from U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. Professor Paul Jorgensen of the University of Texas, who discusses the report he co-authored titled, Who Buys the Spies? The Hidden Corporate Cash Behind America's Out-of-Control National Surveillance State. And Leo Gerard, president of the United Steelworkers Union, who considers effective ways to build alliances between labor and environmental groups. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of the annual Hajj pilgrimage of 1.4 million Muslims to Mecca, Saudi Arabia's public health officials breathed a sigh of relief. Saudi officials had taken unusual precautions to prevent an outbreak of MERS, or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which has killed 130 people in 8 countries. There was also concern about the spread of polio, which has recently broken out in Syria, raising fears in nearby countries. The Saudi kingdom required all participants in this year's Hajj to be vaccinated for polio, a rebuke to jihadi groups across the Middle East who oppose vaccination campaigns. According to Foreign Policy magazine, recent polio outbreaks have occurred in Ethiopia, Somalia, and among Somalia refugees living in Kenya. After 3 polio cases were identified in South Sudan, the United Nations Security Council called for a mass vaccination campaign in the region in mid-October. 2 years ago, public health officials, including philanthropist Bill Gates, were predicting the worldwide elimination of polio. However, that optimism didn't take into account a backlash against vaccinations in many Muslim nations. Hostility against vaccinations occurred after it was revealed that the CIA employed a Pakistani physician to conduct bogus hepatitis B vaccinations in order to confirm the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden before the U.S. raid that killed the Al-Qaeda leader. The Obama administration has relaxed rules for the export of U.S. arms at a time when many military contractors have been squeezed by federal budget cuts. The new rules cover the export of military spare parts and will soon include military vehicles, vessels, and helicopters to 36 ally nations. The reform effort marks a historic change. Thousands of military-related items, once monitored by the State Department's strict export license control system, will move to the Commerce Department's often less restrictive regulatory process. The Commerce Department's principal function is to improve the health of U.S. businesses. But according to ProPublica, some independent groups have expressed concern that this unprecedented relaxation of rules, more than 4 years in the making, could allow terrorists or human rights violators to gain access more easily to militarily useful equipment. Human rights advocates also believe that the new rules could increase the flow of American-made military parts to the world's conflict zones and make it harder to enforce arms sanctions. Arms exports are big business for U.S. military contractors. In 2011, the U.S. government granted licenses for over $66 billion in arms exports to other governments, nearly 80% of all global arms sales. 1 year after a fire at the Chevron oil refinery in Richmond, California, a Bay Area working-class community, over 200 activists were arrested at the plant's gate in a civil disobedience action. A day earlier, the city of Richmond announced it was suing Chevron for damages from the refinery fire which led 15,000 people to seek treatment at area hospitals. Challenging Chevron in the majority-minority city of 100,000 people was unthinkable until recently. For years, Richmond, home to Chevron's 3,000-acre refinery, was run like a company town, where the oil giant could name its own health inspectors. According to the news magazine In These Times, progressive activists shook up Richmond in 2006 when pro-Chevron Mayor Irma Anderson was defeated by environmentalist Gail McLaughlin, a member of the Green Party. Over the last 7 years, Richmond has drafted many progressive policies on a variety of issues, including drug enforcement and affordable housing, rivaling the agenda of liberal bastions San Francisco and Berkeley. Instead of criminalizing the homeless, Richmond allows homeless people to eat and sleep on sidewalks. In August, the city passed a comprehensive Ban the Box ordinance, preventing employers from asking about criminal histories on job applications. Green Party activist Mike Parker observed, "It's precisely because Richmond is working class and facing the same social problems as much of the rest of America that we have to do things to challenge the status quo." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Over the course of the U.S. war against terrorism, and since the Obama administration increased the CIA and military's use of drone strikes, targeting suspected terrorists in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Middle East and North Africa, human rights groups have focused on the controversy surrounding the rising number of civilian casualties resulting from those attacks. Amnesty International recently released a study assessing the consequences of U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan for the period between January 2012 and August 2013. The study, titled "Will I Be Next? U.S. Drone Strikes in Pakistan," is based on detailed field research into 9 of the 45 reported pilotless aircraft attacks that occurred in Pakistan's North Waziristan tribal area near the Afghan border, and a survey of publicly available information on all reported drone strikes in Pakistan during the time frame investigated. The Amnesty report focuses on the death of a 68-year-old grandmother, Maman Abidi, reportedly killed by a U.S. drone in October 2012 while picking vegetables with her grandchildren, and the deaths of 18 laborers killed in July by drones that struck a tent where the men had gathered for an evening meal. Your reporter spoke with Rachel O'Leary, Deputy Director of Membership with Amnesty International USA, who discusses her group's concern that these drone strikes have resulted in unlawful killings that may constitute extrajudicial executions or war crimes, and Amnesty's call for an investigation and accountability under international law.
In October of 2012, a 68-year-old grandmother named Amana Bibi was blasted basically into pieces, killed by two Hellfire missiles while she was gathering vegetables in her fields. And this happened in front of her neighbors and in front of her grandchildren and children, and has really sort of left their community, you know, struggling and terrified that they might be next, which is kind of the point of our report. Because of this case and other cases like it, we reviewed all of the 45 reported U.S. drone strikes that occurred between January 2012 and August 2013 in North Waziristan, which is a region in northwest Pakistan, which has seen the majority of the U.S. strikes. From all of those strikes, we compiled this report that is really rooted in interviews with survivors of drone strikes, relatives of victims, eyewitnesses, residents of affected areas, things like that. You know, we kind of have the broad strokes of what we feel like has been happening, but there's just so much that we still don't know. And so we are calling upon President Obama and Congress to open up investigations and to tell us why, you know, these folks were targeted.
The administration of George W. Bush and President Obama's administration claim that drones are a very precise and technologically advanced form of weaponry that can be safely used with very little civilian casualties involved. And the administration has yet to admit that there are many hundreds of civilians that have died here as a result of frequent drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen and other nations in Africa. What is the route to accountability here, in your view? If there were war crimes committed, as is discussed in the report, what are the methods to bring people before a court of law, either in the United States or some international body?
You know, there's a couple of points here. And the first is that Amnesty doesn't believe that all drone strikes violate human rights or humanitarian law. But the issue around sort of the question that you pose is that we don't know so much of this. The full picture will only come to light when U.S. authorities, you know, sort of disclose the facts and the circumstances and the legal basis for each of the drone strikes. And so I think that the first step is transparency. And from that, we can get accountability. According to U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, the U.S. has killed a total of 4,700 people using drones as of early 2013. But it's really not clear if this is based on official sources or whether it includes individuals killed by drones in Afghanistan and Iraq, and how many of those people were sort of civilians, et cetera. And so there's just so much that we don't know. And, you know, I think the first step is really focusing on how are these drone strikes being authorized, and using what legal framework, how do you get on the list, on these kill and target lists? Those are the type of questions that are still very much so outstanding. President Obama has yet to offer any sort of details along that line. And, you know, we also believe that Congress needs to open impartial and transparent investigations around this as well.
We heard from Malala Yousafzai not that long ago, the 14-year-old Pakistani girl who was shot by the Taliban for her advocacy of education for girls across the Islamic world, in Pakistan specifically. And she had the opportunity to meet with President Obama a couple of weeks back.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she said that the White House really didn't advertise that much, but one of the things she said in her meeting with President Obama was her plea to him to stop the drone strikes in her country, because she stated, as others have stated before, that these drone strikes are creating more terrorists in Pakistan and anywhere else where they cause civilian casualties and a lot of pain and suffering, and hence hate for the country that brought them the drone strikes.
Mm-hmm.
You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken with military officials who acknowledge that, you know, there's a direct relationship to al-Qaeda presence and growth and U.S. military presence, that, you know, our intervention essentially creates and radicalizes people in the area. And I think it's tough, in, you know, sort of in addition to the threat of our drone strikes, the people in North Waziristan, they're caught in the middle. You know, they've got armed groups, they've got Pakistani armed forces. When the local population lives under a constant fear of violence from all sides, the, you know, sort of the rational options for how you move forward with your life become much, much smaller. And we have reports that al-Qaeda-linked groups have killed dozens of local villagers when they're accused of being spies for the U.S. drone strikes. There were residents of Mir Ali told us that bodies are routinely sort of just dumped by the side of the streets with written messages warning that people accused of spying for the U.S. will meet the same fate. So it really creates a negative feedback loop where the people in North Waziristan are less safe. We are less safe because there are more militants and more, you know, sort of radicals, more folks signing up with al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda is stronger. So, you know, when we're talking about goals around national security, this just simply isn't a winning strategy.
That was Rachel O'Leary, Deputy Director of Membership with Amnesty International USA. Find links to Amnesty's Will I Be Next U.S. Drone Strikes in Pakistan report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. New revelations about the scope of America's National Security Agency's surveillance program continued this week, with reports from journalist Glenn Greenwald, working with documents provided by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, detailing U.S. surveillance of phone communications of millions of European citizens and leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Earlier revelations included information that the NSA had long monitored phone data in Brazil, France, Mexico, and more recently, Spain. News reports about the NSA spy program targeting U.S. allies came the same week that thousands gathered in Washington, D.C. for a protest march and rally in opposition to dragnet surveillance. On October 26, a diverse left-right coalition of groups, organized under the banner of Stop Watching Us, called on Congress to investigate the full extent of NSA spy programs and to institute reforms to protect citizens' privacy rights. Your reporter spoke with Paul Jorgensen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Pan American, who discusses a new study he co-wrote with Thomas Ferguson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and UMass statistician Jai Chen, titled Who Buys the Spies? The Hidden Corporate Cash Behind America's Out-of-Control National Surveillance State. Here, Professor Jorgensen talks about the report and the concern that campaign contributions injected into the U.S. political system by companies profiting from surveillance contracts have expanded and institutionalized unaccountable government spying.
We're engaged in a long-term project about accumulating and redoing, reassessing, and hopefully reinvigorating the study of campaign finance. And so this is just a small piece where we look at 2012 and we try to aggregate the money in an important way that hasn't been completely done before by combining two different agencies that collect the data, and we lump it together in terms of what we call an investing unit. So taking all the individuals, the executives, the PACs, the super PACs, and even the firm itself that can give cash in very particular ways, trying to group all that together, and in order to make sense of these different industries and the party fault lines that these industries revolve around. And so, you know, our paper says lots of different things, but we start off with just understanding the business community and break it down between big business and the rest. And then when we actually apply real economic data in terms of industry codes and especially of the Fortune 350 or the Forbes 400 billionaires, we start to see splits develop between different industries. For example, Romney and mainline Republicans, as well as Tea Party members, get a lot of money from, as you'd expect, oil, glass, manufacturing, chemical plants, tobacco, and that can explain the climate change debate pretty well. But also this new surveillance state that is now emerging as a result of lots of different whistleblowers and newspaper coverage. That itself, with the study of political money, may not be that surprising that the Democrats largely support that new military apparatus.
Now, if you could summarize for us your conclusions in terms of the takeaway here was the fact that you have the Obama administration pushing forward with expanding and institutionalizing the surveillance state with a lot of corporate backers from software makers and companies that host websites and the like. Maybe you could summarize that for us.
Oh, sure. Well, conventional wisdom and actually history shows a lot of these companies and their executives would be more likely to be Republicans in some ways, and they still do give a lot to the Republican Party. And so what our takeaway from looking at this industry is Obama did very, very well, in fact, maybe unusually well, with these industries. And that itself can tell you about policy changes now and in the future, or the likelihood of this being reversed in the future is not very high, unless, you know, the protests and voters are mobilized on this issue. That's a large takeaway, is that this is an emerging split between the Democrats and Republicans, and as it stands now, you might see some silence on this issue, given the amount of cash that goes to both sides.
Professor Jorgensen, President Eisenhower, when he left office, made a very famous farewell speech where he warned the country about the development of the military-industrial complex, speaking about it in terms of its threat to democracy and undermining our political institutions. What kind of parallels can you make with what's developed in recent years with the national surveillance state and maybe along the same lines of what President Eisenhower warned the country about?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I mean, the parallels are all there. There's too many to count. And so if we go back and we dig through that speech, Eisenhower has something pressing to say about the military-industrial complex. In general, it's the merger between the defense industry and the economy. But in terms of its influence on democracy, it's the rise of a technocratic state in the realm of foreign policy. And we have technocratic decisions being made that are largely done in secret and then are not conveyed well to the public. And so it's very hard for the public to understand, or, you know, anybody to understand what actually is the level of communication between these private companies and the state. So what we see now is, you know, the military-industrial complex, and we should call it by its name, is now taking a different shape. And the shape it's taking is with these high-tech companies. And the thrust of our argument is that when you have this rise of a new industry, they become very important in the realm of party conflict. And this looks an awful lot like what a political scientist would call clientelism, which is simply just interest group politics meant to get favors, and you're trying to keep the issue out of the public realm. And the use of technocratic language in this case, you can find the merger between the economy and the state. You can find the reliance of employment in this country on defense. And so you have a lot of U.S. citizens employed in the defense industry in one way or another. And now you have a growth of very highly educated people in the tech industry that are being used for defense. And so the symbol of the military-industrial complex is very important to understand in all its dimensions, because it's still alive and well.
That was Paul Jorgensen, assistant professor of political science at the University of Texas Pan American. Read the Who Buys the Spies report that Professor Jorgensen co-wrote by following links on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 5,000 young people converged in Pittsburgh for the Biennial Power Shift Conference, October 18th through the 21st, where the focus is on the next generation's response to climate disruption. Pittsburgh is also the headquarters of the United Steelworkers Union. With more than 850,000 members, it's the largest industrial union in North America and includes many workers not affiliated with the steel industry. Leo Girard has served as the Steelworkers Union president since 2001, and under his leadership, the union has been a leading advocate of the principle that good jobs and environmental protection can go hand in hand. First with the Apollo Alliance, and subsequently through the Blue-Green Alliance, the Steelworkers Union has allied with the Sierra Club and other environmental groups to pursue common goals without needing to agree on everything. Girard was unable to attend October's PowerShift conference in person, but sent a video message laying out some of the union's history and calling for the retrofitting of America's infrastructure and buildings and allocating more resources toward research and development to address environmental technology gaps. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Leo Girard after the conference about how he developed his environmental credentials, the current priorities of his union, and the value of working with a power shift generation.
I grew up in a mining and smelting community in northern Ontario in Canada in the 60s. People came to practice if they were landing on the moon, because there were parts of the community that I lived in where there was literally no vegetation. And that happened as a result of early in the 1900s, where there was smelting by creating mounds of ore covered with clear-cut wood from clear-cutting the forest and setting fire to the wood that would melt the ore and burn off the sulfur, and it would get blown along the ground. And because the trees were gone, there was nothing to hold the soil, and when it rained, the soil would wash away, so the rocks became granite black rocks. And so that was the legacy left from the turn of the 18th to 19th century. And then growing up and working in that environment, we had an employer who told us we had to choose between a clean environment and good jobs. Being activists in the union, I was just a kid. I wasn't the lead activist. I was just a participant. But the lead activist on our Health, Safety, and Environment Committee challenged that, and young folks like me went along with that. And what we learned is that we could actually clean up the environment and still have good jobs.
Leo Girard, the steelworkers have been in the forefront of environmental and even climate change activism for decades. Can you give us some highlights?
The steelworkers held the first what would now be called an environmental conference, which was then called an anti-pollution conference, in 1963. Then we participated in numerous programs, including Great Lakes Rehabilitation, the sort of International Acid Rain Treaty. We had a huge internal debate in the union on the Clean Air, Clean Water Act, which we supported. then in 1991, which is seems like a long time ago, our union endorsed a paper at our international convention where we said that climate change was going to be one of the most important issues facing the next generation. We, in a statement called Our Children's World. And then about 20 years later, we reissued a paper securing our children's future. And so for us, the debate over blue-green has been one that we've been a leader in. One of the things we know for sure, if we modernize our infrastructure, that means rail, transportation, air, bridges, roads, pipelines. If we modernize all that, if we put together a long-term public program of retrofitting our public buildings to the highest degree scientifically possible, we would generate huge amounts of research and development.
What was your message to PowerShift participants in your video?
I think that the message that we were sending is that there's going to be controversial issues that come up, and we shouldn't get ourselves too polarized over those controversial parts of the issues, because we can do huge, huge amounts to improve the environment by simply aggressively and for the long term going after the low-hanging fruit, as I call it, the kind of stuff that I talked about.
How important are these fired-up young people among your allies working to address climate change?
I think it's an important group of allies for the purposes of making sure that we understand that climate change is real and it has to be dealt with. I would be a little hesitant to, and I support the president's position of we need to be supportive of all forms of energy. I understand the controversy over fossil fuels, but the fact of the matter is until we can take carbon out of the atmosphere by retrofits, until we can create enough renewable energy, we're going to need fossil fuels. And the fact of the matter is that one of the things we need to be fighting for is obviously a just transition for those workers that will be affected as we evolve out of that. And we also need to be demanding as we evolve, we don't stop doing the research to do it as environmentally sound as possible. We should be sitting down and talking about how can we reduce greenhouse gas emissions on a collective basis while at the same time protecting and creating jobs.
That was Leo Girard, president of the United Steelworkers Union. For more information and commentary on building alliances between labor and environmental groups, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.